From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last Thursday when Saturday Night Live aired a special edition featuring a six-minute commentary by Tina Fey. The former SNL star is a graduate of the University of Virginia, and she talked about the events in Charlottesville. It was, of course, comedy, but it carried a strong tinge of outrage and seriousness. And during the sketch, Fey unveiled a sheet cake with an American flag and began eating it. She urged Americans to support local bakeries, and instead of going out to counter-protest the white supremacists, she asked them to stay home and eat cake. Fey concluded that white supremacists want attention, and it's time to ignore them. Stay home. Starve them of the attention they want. Her commentary spread quickly across the internet, and while it drew many cheers, it also then sparked a strong backlash. Critics said that Fey was tone-deaf, offering advice from a comfortable place of privilege. Concerned about the state of our country? Stay home and stress eat. For many Americans, that's the logical thing to do. They can afford to stay home. For others, there is no choice. They can't afford to sit this one out. And the critics said that Fey was promoting a kind of progressivism that becomes a poor ally. There are echoes from this past January, when hundreds of thousands joined the Women's March in Washington, but many women of color argue that white women have let them down for a long time, marching for reproductive rights, sure, but rarely racial and social justice beyond their own bubbles. It was an uncomfortable conversation, and it has not ended. This hour, a discussion of so-called sheetcake feminism and also what it means to really be an ally. My guests this hour include Vanessa Cheeks, who's a reporter for Open Mic Rochester. Vanessa, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
Also here is Jackie McGriff, a feminist, a photographer. Nice to see you back here at WXXI, Jackie.
Thank you.
Great to have you. Amber Tracy is a local artist and an art educator. Amber, welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
And Dr. Elizabeth Thorpe is assistant professor of communications at the College of Brockport. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
I guess we should start by listening to some of the clips here. And we reached out to potential guests who held a range of views. It just so happens it was difficult to convince anyone to come in and really defend Tina Fey's sketch. But, you know, listeners, maybe you saw it and maybe you don't understand the criticism. Maybe you, you haven't seen it yet. So what we're going to do is we're going to listen to the core of Fey's commentary. So you're going to hear about a minute from the heart of it where she kind of talks about her feelings on sheetcake feminism, as it's been called, and then her conclusion. Let's listen.
I would urge people this Saturday, instead of participating in the screaming matches and potential violence, find a local business you support, maybe a Jewish-run bakery or an African-American-run bakery. Order a cake with the American flag on it, like this one, and just eat it, Colin.
Wait, I'm sorry, how is that supposed to help?
Love is love, Colin.
Sorry, what?
And then next time when you see a bunch of white boys in polo shirts screaming about taking our country back, and you want to scream, it's not our country, we stole it from the Native Americans. We stole it from the Native Americans, and when they have a peaceful protest at Standing Rock, we shoot at them with rubber bullets, but we let you chinless turds march through the streets with semi-automatic weapons. And when you want to yell that, don't yell it at the Klan, Colin. Yell it into the cake. I really want to say, to encourage all good, sane Americans to treat these rallies this weekend like the opening of a thoughtful movie with two female leads. Don't show up. Let these morons scream into the empty air. I love you, Charlottesville. And as Thomas Jefferson once said, who's that hot light-skinned girl over by the butter churn?
That's Tina Fey. And she, again, she punctuated it at the end. What I really want to say, Vanessa Cheeks, when you hear those remarks, is that satire to you? Is she ribbing comfortable women who don't get involved, or did that really sound like a call to eat sheet cake and not show up to counter protest?
I definitely thought when I first watched it.
Yeah, just get real close to your microphone. We don't hear you next week. Yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. I definitely thought when I first watched it that she was, you know, hitting satire on the mark when she was kind of poking fun at stress eating about this whole situation, basically starting with Donald Trump and kind of ending with what's happening in Charlottesville. But then when she did say, you know, this is what I would really like to say, that's kind of when my ears perked up, because that was her opportunity to kind of make it very clear about what her message was. And her message ultimately was to stay home and not engage. And what kind of stresses me out, you know, as a black woman is that we engage, we have to engage. People of color do so, and we have done so in order to regain our rights. So it's kind of like saying that they're going to leave us behind to kind of just sit home.
I guess it sounds like you think in that last minute, her summation, she had a chance to pivot and say, okay, I've been joking about the cake. And then we all stress eat when we're feeling that kind of strain.
Yeah.
But now's the time to get beyond stress eating and get out of the streets.
And get out.
But she did the opposite.
She did the exact opposite.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was before that joke about Sally Hemings, and it was just kind of all very poorly placed. And like I said, it just seemed as if she had that opportunity and she kind of gave it away and made it very clear that the intention was to ignore these people. And, you know, they're not ignoring us. They're making it clear, they're coming out and they're showing that they support their ideas, and we should do the same.
Tina Fey's defenders include Playboy magazine's Tom Carson, who wrote a piece called The Brilliance of Tina Fey's Cake Satire Explained. And he went on to say that this was just satire, and she was using the cake to expose the hypocrisy of lazy sheet cake feminism. You buy that?
I don't buy it because it assumes that we don't know what a joke is. We know what satire is, you know, and if you're not 100% sure, you can Google it and... We know it's a joke. We know what it was, but it doesn't make it funny and it doesn't make it right. So.
Okay. And before I go to the other guests, I just want to also ask you, I saw on Twitter, you were kind of admonishing even local bakeries to say, hey, slow down before you start cranking out feminist sheet cakes, which we actually saw bakeries across the country jumping on the Tina Fey's commentary and saying, hey, pick up your American flag feminist sheet cakes. And,
yeah.
And your feeling on that was, see, look, even if it was meant to be a satire, it didn't land because this is what people are doing. They're buying cake.
It didn't land. And I think in general for businesses, before you kind of use these movements for sales or marketing purposes, you really need to understand what backlash is going to be with it. And with social media, it comes quickly. So you can definitely look it up without wasting too much time. What I will also say is if you're a bakery and you are not a black owned or Jewish owned bakery, like she said in her skit, you really have no right to be peddling any type of pastries based off of this incident, based off of any movement, you know, that doesn't apply to you. I think it's grotesque, basically.
Okay. Jackie McGriff, how did you feel about the commentary? We'll start there from Tina Fey.
Okay. So when I first watched it, I thought it was hilarious, and I kept watching and I kept watching and I kept watching it. Number one, I didn't know that there was backlash about it at all. Like, I hadn't looked up any of that or anything. I saw it, the first time I saw it was on Facebook. Someone had posted it and everything, and I think they cut off at the last part that you were talking about, Vanessa. And so when I watched it again this morning on YouTube, the entire clip was there. And so that did kind of like rub me the wrong way. And I was like, yeah, that's your opportunity to be like, no, you should go out. You should volunteer. You should, you know, talk to people. You should do things. My only thing, though, is when you were talking about like, or when she was talking about like, go to a Jewish owned bakery or an African American owned bakery. Like, I took that to mean like when our president, like when we find out who our president was going to be and everything, I know coworkers and when I was working here at WXXI who went out and they purposely, like, they would go to lunch and they would pick out like people or immigrants who owned restaurants, and they would purposely go to lunch at those restaurants. I think, to me at least, that was what she was kind of pointing at, not necessarily like, even though it may not have been the best executed, but what she was trying to do was trying to point to, hey, there are these businesses that we sort of overlook because we're so used to seeing like one type of person own a business. We're not going out and actively reaching out to those who may have been targeted during this campaign and during the presidency so far. So I think that's where she was going towards. And I mean, for the most part, like, I was taking it as satire, but there are some things that like really kind of hit me. There's things throughout this entire skit that kind of hit me, and not necessarily in a negative way, and more of like a a positive way, an empowering way, which she said about, like, them, like, Native Americans peacefully protesting. And as someone who's both an African American and Cherokee, like, I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, yeah, she called it out. She was saying, you know, you go out there, they're Native Americans, right, or they're Native Americans at Standing Rock that are peacefully protesting, and we fire back at them with these rubber bullets. Meanwhile, there are these white nationalists who are going out with tiki torches and everything with semi-automatic weapons, and no one does anything. And there's only the counter-protesters there, you know, and we're getting this rhetoric about, you know, there being violence on both sides and all this stuff. And so that, to me, is what stuck out. Like, I didn't even bother, like, seeing if there was backlash, because that was something, for me at least, in that skit that really just sort of hit me and, you know, just made me, like, yeah, like, okay, we need to do something. I can't just, like, sit here and agree with her, you know, on that aspect. I need to actually go out there and do something about it. You know, put my money where my mouth is.
All right, so that's a more positive view of what Tina Fey was saying at least she's calling out our real history, yeah. Native American dispossession, mm-hmm. and pointing out the hypocrisy of what happens at Standing Rock versus right. what happens in Charlottesville. And so if you're wondering, what would Tina Fey say about this? This is where I kind of get a little annoyed. She said in 2015 that she's done explaining her jokes. She did an interview with Net a Porter, and she says she's decided not to explain jokes. She said, I feel like we put so much effort into writing and crafting everything. They need to speak for themselves. There's a real culture of demanding apologies, and I'm opting out of that.
Yeah.
Okay, you know? I mean, before I go across state, like, Vanessa, I,
you know, honestly, my friend asked me about that. She was like, and she mentioned that quote, and I don't want an apology. I don't necessarily think that that would be productive. But what I do think is that as somebody who puts herself out there, she's a pretty famous person. People know her. She has a voice, and she does have an obligation to people. If she's going to present a message, take the criticism, just take it and roll with it. So I think that it, again, it's an opportunity for her to at least acknowledge, you know, where there is fault. But, you know, I also don't necessarily see it being productive to kind of guess at what she was saying. I think you can take her words for what they are, and it is what it is.
Yeah, and I think most people didn't take it as satire. You know, which is exactly why, like, I totally understand when Vanessa says, even to Jackie's point, she's making this important point about the distinction between Standing Rock and Charlottesville, and then she could turn around and say, so when you're done stress eating about that, have you been to Standing Rock? Are you going to be there? You know?
And you're a bakery, but are you a black-owned or Jewish-owned bakery selling these sheet cakes? Yeah. And if the answer is no, then...
Yeah. Let's go across the table. Amber Tracy, what did you make of the commentary?
Well, when I first sat down, I watched it with my roommate after, you know, we had a long day at work, and it was a long day of debating people on the internet about, you know, racism and white oppression, a term that was explained to me that is real, that is just completely beyond me. But anyways, I watched this and I was extremely enraged. The whole idea that it was satire went completely over my head, and I took it as this is an extremely powerful white female comedian going on the air and saying that it's fine. You don't have to care if you're white. You can just dissociate and not participate in society in what's happening. And that's the issue. If you can't tell that it's satire, it's not satire to me. And my biggest issue was she made some really great points, right? She had, like, little jabs at the president that were hilarious. But that was all juxtaposed in between what was maybe satire, maybe not satire, and I just couldn't tell what was happening. It was extremely confusing and, in my opinion, kind of irresponsible. If you're going on national television, you have to be able to prove what your intent is. And, I mean, it's great that her intent was to make fun of this, but at the same time, my other big question is, why exactly is this acceptable material for satire? One of the first things I thought of is, how would the parents of the people who were brutally murdered in the street, and, you know, have been being murdered in our streets for years, react to this? What are they going to say when their personal lives are made into satire? And I was just kind of, like, really disappointed and disgusted by it.
Okay. Dr. Thorpe.
So I find the satire question to be interesting and maybe a little bit disingenuous. I think we throw around the round word satire a lot when really what we're just talking about is exaggeration and political comedy. Satire is something that's very specific. Like if you go to the urtext of satire, right, you look at A Modest Proposal. He spends pages and pages and pages of saying the exact opposite of what he really means. And in the last page, he provides sort of a textual analysis key in which he says, certainly we should not do the following things, and then lays out exactly what we really should do. And that's what satire does. It uses literary irony to say, here is the exact opposite of what I really intend. If you look at this sketch as satire, then it completely falls flat because she goes through, here's the exact opposite of what I mean, and then when given the opportunity to give that textual analysis key, here's what I really mean, the answer is stay home. So I don't see the satirical element in it because I don't think she's saying the opposite of what she means and encouraging us to be our best selves. She's just saying what she means throughout the entire time. That's not satire. It's political humor, yes. It's exaggeration, yes, and it's certainly plugging into the current discourse, but it doesn't fit any definition of satire. And we use satire as a catch-all for things that are political or uncomfortable or exaggerated or even carnivalesque, but satire is a specific thing. And when we throw that term around and we forget what it means, it becomes a catch-all for bad politics. And what we saw here, I think, was just kind of peak white feminism at work. And to explain it away as satire devalues both role that satire can play. I think if you look at the difference between Stewart and Colbert, Colbert was a satirist, Stewart was a comedian, and they both had their roles to play, but they were very, very different roles. Satire is when you're saying the opposite of what you mean and then providing the textual clues for us to figure that out. That's not what happened here. What we saw was a woman telling us to stay home. And when the political lines are being drawn with the bodies of certain people in certain marginalized communities, that's a dangerous message.
Let me get our first phone call. I know a lot of listeners want to weigh in and had a chance to hear and see what Tina Fey had to say, and want to weigh in on a number of angles here. So Kate in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Kate.
Oh, hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And I really appreciate the comments that have been made by the guests. I do have a differing opinion, and especially that Tina has provided some textual context for us in those last comments. I think she's literally making a call to action to do nothing. I think the textual context she's framing it in is placed by telling us to do what we do when we, there's a movie with two female leads, a thoughtful movie with two female leads, which puts that in the context of, okay, we're just going to be complacent. I think she's being consistent with that satirical element through the end by placing the onus on us to face our own hypocrisy that, yeah, we don't go see these movies. We don't support arts that, have females in leads. No one supports that who is in line with these, thoughtful approach. So using that comedy consistently through her thread, I think does carry that opposite notion of what she's saying. So I think that's probably her intention, is just to point out our hypocrisy to the very end, like, okay, yeah, go ahead, be complacent, stuff your face with food. I don't think she's literally telling us to do that.
Yeah, so Kate, let me just ask you a quick question, and then I'll let our guest weigh in as well. I understand what you're saying, and I appreciated the line about a thoughtful movie with two female leads and stay home. To my ear, that sounded like saying, hey, you're already good at staying home when you shouldn't, but this time, since you're so good at it, do it. Stay home. Don't show up. Don't be there. That's the thing to do in this case. So maybe that was a way to knock people for not supporting movies with female leads.
Yeah.
But she seemed to be saying, you're already good at this, so keep it up. And seriously, in this case. No,
right,
no?
But sarcastically, in a tone that's challenging to us as a viewer, as continuing on with our sort of blissful ignorance.
Kate, thank you for the phone call. I'll go around the table and get a response from guests here. Vanessa, what do you make of that?
I think she makes a good point, but from my point of view, I see that as a person of color, we're kind of tired of joking about this. We've asked, not only in protests, but also just in general in the community for help, for no more complacency from people. So it's kind of like, if you see it as a joke, it's a tired joke. And it's kind of we have been challenging people to kind of come out and support us during the Black Lives Matter movement. You know, it took Heather Heyer to die for people to say, you know, oh, this is dangerous. And it's like, how many countless Black activists are dead? It is dangerous. And we've been telling people that it's dangerous. So does it take Tina Fey to kind of get you off your butt and out into the streets? I guess that's the question that I would pose.
Okay. Jackie?
Well, to answer your question, Vanessa, I mean, when you have that sort of platform, yeah, you have a responsibility to, you know, to, if you're going to call out something and then follow through on it, but also encourage people as well. But then again, it's also on all of us. It really is. It's on us to, you know, just to come together and support the things that we want to see implemented. We want to see that Black Lives Matter, you know, but in the system, in the court system, in our prison system, in our schools, in every single aspect. In this country, race runs deep, and all lives can't matter until Black lives matter, and really, like, equally, all lives will matter at that point. But we can't move forward with that until, like, there's a group of us, there's all of us working together, you know, to make sure that that happens. So I think on both sides there. So for, you know, people saying, well, she has this responsibility, you had this opportunity. That's true. But also in this case too, because it's not gonna, I mean, we've seen so many speeches from celebrities at the Oscars, at the Golden Globes, at every single award ceremony, you know, to try to get people to say, hey, you know, these things matter. We really need to come together and do this. That is fantastic. And at the same time, though, it's on us too, because, I mean, the celebrities, they can only say things. It takes us actually doing stuff in order to see these things come through, to see people's lives changed.
And Dr. Thorpe, I had an email from a listener who wanted a definition from you. You used the term peak white feminism, and a listener wanted to know what you meant by that. I wonder if it is in the context of the discussion we heard around the Women's March back in January, where there were these discussions about, number one, are you only going to show up one day a year to march and go back to a comfortable life and not do the work? And has that historically sort of been the case in feminism? How would you describe peak white feminism?
So there is a big discussion in activist communities and the feminist community right now about white feminism versus a more inclusive or intersectional version of feminism. And as some people have already talked about, there has been a real issue with the sort of middle-class white feminists not understanding the ways that race plays into women's issues. And this is going back to the second wave. We can see this kind of being an issue all throughout. And when people talk about white feminism, what they often mean is a sort of, at best, race blind, at worst, racist version of feminism that is exclusive of people of color. This also is an instance in which it becomes very clear that white feminists have expected people of color or people from the GLBT community or other marginalized communities to do a lot of the work of equality, because, as the sketch points out, white feminists have the opportunity to stay home if we want. Our bodies and human dignity isn't on the line the way that certain other communities are. This isn't life and death in the same way that it is for some other groups. So white feminists have gotten a bit of a pass in the last few years, as this has become a more and more intersectional movement. So there's a criticism of what is being termed white feminism right now, which is sort of, to put it lightly, ignorant of the way that women's issues are intersectional with issues of people of color, the GLBT community, any number of other marginalized communities. It's a really fascinating conversation, and I would encourage people to look into what white feminism is and the critiques of it, because I think it's going to be very important as we move forward in the women's movement.
All right, I'm late for a break, and what I want to do is, we've got a lot of phone calls lined up, and from what I'm seeing on the board, a lot of really interesting points. If you're on the line, I'd like to get through all of the calls, and I know there are some some criticism. So here comes some. And our guests are going to talk about that and more. Vanessa Cheeks, a reporter for Open Mic Rochester. Jackie McGriff is a feminist, photographer, former WXXIer right here in the building. Nice to see you back here. Amber Tracy, a local artist and art educator. And Dr. Elizabeth Thorpe, an assistant professor of communications at the College of Brockport. We'll go to your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, if the Rochester Fringe Festival were an hour of connections, what would it sound like? You're going to find out. We've got roughly a dozen performers from the upcoming Fringe Festival, people who have written, people who will be performing, music, all kinds of things. It's a fast-moving hour, a chance for you to hear quick interviews and previews with the people behind the Fringe Festival, and it's all next hour on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Peter on Twitter says, guys, it's comedy. Get a grip.
Thanks, Peter. That was really insightful.
Wow. Oh, my God. I feel so much better. Wow.
Let's get some phone calls. Gail in Rochester. Go ahead, Gail.
I think all the comments are very enlightening to me. I don't disagree, but it struck me completely different. I think that we have so much work to do, and especially the ideas about white feminism and the idea that we white people don't really understand racism or institutional racism. It was really brought home to me at the rally after Charlottesville in Rochester. I feel like a lot of people were lectured to about, you know, it's great that you're here, but you really don't get it, and what are you going to do? And I feel like we don't really all know each other, and there's so much work to be done. It's like peeling back layers of an onion. We don't really know each other. There's so much work to be done, and for a lot of people, just getting involved again is exhausting, thinking that they were done years ago. People who thought that, you know, getting shocked by the election and thinking they were done, and that was stupid, you know. Well, yeah, the country wasn't what they thought that it was. Anyway, it goes on and on. There is a lot of work to do. A lot of people do care. They do want to work. They're not going to stay home. But what Tina Fey said with that cake just struck me as perfect and hilarious. I would love to just sit and eat a cake. And when she said, women I know have been doing it once a week since the election, that just struck me as so many people I know. We don't eat the cake, but we talk about it like that. You have to have some humor to get through this. It is exhausting to do this work, to think about this, and to figure out what we're going to do to fix this country.
Gail, thank you. Stay there, and I appreciate this. I mean, first of all, I appreciate Gail calling and saying, number one, you know, she's listening, and certain things are opening up for her, but she still feels like, you know, there's a difference of opinion. So, Vanessa, what do you think?
I think that, you know, I definitely understand it is exhausting. And I would also like to point out one thing I got from Tina Fey's skit is that self-care during this time is very important. When you're going, you know, you see it on the news, you see it online, on social media all the time, it can be very taxing. So you should take the time to kind of step back before you jump back into it. But I will say, Gail, to your point when you said that you thought you were done, is that there are lots of people who have not stopped ever to try to gain rights for themselves, for other people. And so, you know, we're tired too, but you gotta kind of keep going.
I get that. I realize the day after the election how wrong I was. I mean, and I think that's the lesson here. We never were done. We never finished. In fact, we never really started. The country has so much work to do. You know, it never really got started. Mm. You know, it was a huge wake-up call for a lot of people. And I just think, you know, without humor, we'll all just fall apart. I took it as humor. I took it as political humor. I thought it was fabulous. It was great.
Gail, thank you for the phone call. I think, Amber, I saw you flinch a little when she said she was exhausted.
Yeah, I mean, I just, when I think about being exhausted, and I am exhausted with having these conversations and fighting this fight, I still have to acknowledge that I'm white. I will never be directly impacted by what is happening in our country right now. And so that means I have to become an ally. I have to constantly step up to the plate and fight for those who are dying. And I think there's no bigger struggle than dying, than watching your family die, than watching your friends die, than watching people get shot in the streets for no reason and feeling exhausted about that. And I don't agree that most people who see that happen sit down and eat a cake, but I might agree that most white people can dissociate and choose to do that, and that's the wrong choice. We have to step up to the plate. We have to be allies. It's easier for us to fight this fight. I mean, just think about it. Was there a black person on SNL voicing their opinions about this, doing satire about it? No. Tina Fey is white. Tina Fey has power, and I think she could have used her power as a very influential comedian in a different way to send a different message.
Okay. Jackie McGriff, what do you think?
So to Gil's point about, she was saying that we don't all know each other. And I think, I can't tell you how many times I've heard the words communication is key. Communication is key. So I think our problem right now is like, first of all, there are some people who will go out of their way to just talk to people from many different ideologies, from different backgrounds and everything. But a lot of us, we're just going about our day thinking about what we need to do through the day and not really actively thinking about what can I be doing to just make myself more enlightened to what's going on, other than like just watching the news. I mean, that's it. Like, you're one person watching the news and everything and seeing what's going on. And people are listening to all different kinds of news. I think what we need to do is, I know we're all tired. I'm tired of like constantly arguing with people on Facebook. It's exhausting. But I think what we need to do is like, just start the conversation with people, or keep doing what you're doing with that at least. But also just going out and befriend, like just talking to people. Like, you can invite people, invite people over, invite your neighbors over. I can't tell you. I've been living at the same residence for pretty much all my life, and I haven't, like, I hardly know my neighbors. Like, there's the person like that's right next to us, but that's pretty much it. Like, I'm not going out and, saying hello or like just getting to know them and everything. Because once you get to know someone, you can have those deeper conversations. Like, you can't just walk up to someone and say, well, how do you feel about this? Or how do you feel about that? It takes building relationships with people. And that, I think, is less of a, I think it's less of an ask, at first at least, less of an ask, to actually go out there and actually talk to people. And I'm of African descent. I am someone who's lived in the suburbs her entire life, surrounded by white people. So I never really thought about any of that up until, I think it was probably college, a little bit after college, where I just started talking to people and everything, and I was finding all these different kinds of things that they had to go through, because I myself had never really seen a whole lot. I may have seen like some microaggressions here and there, and I think that's an entirely different conversation that you've had many times on this show, Evan, but I haven't seen like police beat my family. I haven't seen relatives imprisoned for no reason, or because they fit the description. I haven't seen that. But what I have seen are conversations, and I've been in conversations where people have said that this is something that's happened. This is something that is happening to me. And so when my eyes were open to that, when we're having these discussions and everything, then minds start to open, and then you're like, oh, what can I do? What can I do? Because if you're that sort of person that hears something and you're like, there has to be something done about this, and you get with a group of people that feel the same way, I think that's where you start to see the change. You build those relationships, then you start talking about these things, and you make a change.
Let me ask Dr. Thorpe to weigh in on what we heard from the phone call. And by the way, if you're on the phone, we're still working through a lot here, but please hang there. But let me read you a couple of quick emails as well. One from Jane, who says, Evan, I am so over the far left's collective outrage syndrome. Everything is offensive or problematic, which is a highly overused word, particularly on the show, that gained omnipresence thanks to Tumblr. That's from Jane. Phil emailed the program this morning. Phil in Rochester, who heard the tease for the program, he says, Evan, I'm a straight white male, and I try to check my privilege constantly. I'd like to be the best ally I can be. So with that in mind, here's my concern. I don't want to see progressives destroy each other. We're on the same team. We're fighting the same fight. I know that some of us can do much better and be better allies, but sometimes we're criticized in over-the-top ways. We're told, stop speaking. Then we're told, don't be silent. We're told to shut up and back away when we're trying to help. We're attacked for not being a perfect ally. I'm not saying we shouldn't be critiqued, but I am saying it feels like sometimes it's a test, and if we don't pass with 100%, we're cast out of the movement. And to me, that feels like the way to keep losing, and I don't want Trump or the alt-right to win anymore. So Phil and Jane, similar sentiments, saying it feels to them like a purity test here, and that this is a way for the left to destroy itself as opposed to focus on the fight here.
So I'm going to, there's a lot in there, so I'm going to address one thing at a time. The first thing I think we should consider for a moment is it's very easy to sort of blow this off as one person said, oh, it's just comedy, or oh, this is tangential, or this is a purity test. But there's something in the media called the Tina Fey effect. This is a legitimate thing that people talk about. And it's that when Tina Fey was doing her impression of Sarah Palin during the election season, it changed things. The way people viewed Sarah Palin, the way people thought about the campaign cycle, the way people thought about the election changed because of what Tina Fey was doing in public discourse. So we can't ignore the work that is done in the entertainment industry, and we can't even ignore specifically what is done by Tina Fey, because she has made a lasting impact on political discourse. So I think it is important to, that's not me being theoretical in my ivory tower. No, we can look at the ways in which this one person has impacted politics and is continuing to do so. So I think it is legitimate to sit and ask what happened at this moment, not in a purity test kind of way, but to say, all right, here is a politically important person. What did she say to us? That's a legitimate question. So I don't mean to set this up as a purity test. I don't mean this to say, oh, you're not good enough if you didn't understand it the way I did. But there is a history here of somebody being a potent figure in politics, even though she is not a politician. And we need to treat her as such. Right. She deserves that.
And to Phil and Jane asking, is the left going to destroy itself?
Right. That's the second part of that question. A colleague recently challenged me to ask whether it is even possible to be an ally, and I've been really taken with this question. And the question was, can somebody like me, who consistently benefits from the systems that oppress others, can I really be a true ally at any given point in time? I can be supportive, I can be understanding, I can be an activist, but can I really be an ally if I am consistently the beneficiary of these systemic problems? And I think I don't know what to do with that question yet. I'm still sort of pondering it. But these are the questions we need to ask. I don't think it necessarily tears the left apart so much as it gives us something to work toward together. If it's not okay, if I can't be a good ally because of X, Y, and Z, that's where you're setting up a litmus test. If we need to talk about what the definition of allyship is, that's something we can work together with. I need to hear from other people. What can I do? How can I better work within this system? Or do we need to talk about the system at large? So I think the idea of allyship in and of itself becomes a central issue here. What does it mean to be an ally? And I don't think that necessarily means we're setting up a purity test. I think that means we're having the important kinds of conversations that move things forward.
Are there too many people who are going to take their ball and go home if they feel like Phil does? And I appreciate the email from Phil this morning. I mean, he's sharing his thoughts. But are there too many people who are feeling a little fragile, feeling like, well, I've been criticized here, so, you know, I'm not going to be part of this?
I have little sympathy for that kind of fragility, to be perfectly honest. And I say that as somebody who has been guilty of it myself, right? Like, I get criticized, I get called out, and you have to get to a point where you can say, all right, is this a learning moment? Are we going to move forward? Or are we fracturing? And it is incumbent on those of us who get called out to decide to move forward.
As opposed to kind of go home. But Phil would say, pragmatically, we're going to lose again. On Phil's side, he feels like we're going to lose over this. And you're saying he needs to look within, find that strength, take a little criticism. Vanessa, how do you feel about it?
Well, I think, too, that it's easy to kind of feel that way when you're being criticized about the same things. But I think it's important to know that those doing the criticizing are also criticizing themselves. We criticize within our own community around things that have to do with culture that don't have anything to do with people like Phil. So we are taking ourselves to task in addition. So it's not just you. And like she said, you know, there's very little sympathy there because you got to kind of take your emotions out of it and take the criticism. Just try to do better. It doesn't mean that you're going to be perfect. It doesn't mean that you're always going to pass that test, like he said. But if you're aware and you're trying, that's pretty much all that you're being asked to do. And if doing that is a problem, then you're not a real ally. But for me specifically, in this time, in this moment, and dealing with people who do opt out of participating, my only criteria personally for an ally is to know that somebody is going to stand with me when it counts. And if I don't know that, if I don't feel comfortable, if I don't feel confident, then you are not an ally to me. But if, like, you're at the next Black Lives Matter rally and, you know, you stand between me and somebody who does not want me to live, then that, to me, is all I need.
Tremendous amount of feedback. Susan writes to us and says, I think Tina Fey was not engaging in satire. I think she was literally making the point that when the KKK and alt-right groups hold these rallies, they are trying to provoke the opposition, and it is actually better to stay home rather than fuel their fire. So Susan is saying, yes, that message landed right with me, that stay home. Susan said it didn't sound like satire to her, stay home. Whereas Lana says she thinks the whole point was that sheet-caking as a grassroots movement is a gag, a funny and communicative take. She called it brilliant comedy. Dan says, as an older white male, it was not lost on me that Tina, a white woman, was sitting in front of a very large white cake with an American flag on it and eating it to excess. The textual clue was the cake. She was giving us a message about white privilege. So, okay, a lot of different takes on this. Let me get back to the phone. I want to make sure we work in more of your phone calls here. Angela, let's see here. Yes, Angela in Rochester next. Go ahead, Angela.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call, and I just wanted to share my deepest gratitude to all of the guests. Thank you so, so much for all of your comments. So I just wanted to point out that, you know, we have so many relevant issues right here in Rochester that contribute to white supremacy, you know, like we have a huge lack of police accountability. There's a massive amount of non-white folks living in poverty right now. You know, a Carrington man just attacked an elderly man for allegedly being a communist. You know, so I guess while I see how this conversation is really important, I ask, like, you know, why are we spending a full hour discussing a comedian's semantics when we could be talking about productively about challenging white supremacy right in Rochester?
It's called multitasking. We are allowed to do both. We can talk about multiple things, and that's really all I have to say.
Well, and I also think this sketch is directly related to every incident you just cited that's happening here in Rochester. We have to tackle it all.
Okay. Here's an example of how I mentioned Susan's email saying she received it as a literal message. Stay home. Don't counter protest. Which, by the way, after we saw in Boston over the weekend with a huge counter protest, we have seen some other alt-right rallies been canceled around the country, perhaps as a result of that. But Louise says, I thought it was clear. Tina was pointing out how powerless many people feel right now, and particularly pointing out that many of us may be stress eating or whatever to take our minds off of it, but she was not advocating that as a solution. Her words in between bites were meant to remind us how screwed up things are and that we can't behave like ostriches or cake eaters when what we need to be are active citizens of this country. So Louise took the message as, don't be a cake eater or a sheet cake orderer. Get out there. Chris in Rochester. Go ahead, sir.
Hey, it's Chris Thompson. I had a couple of points that people already made regarding the whole point of it being satire. I do comedy. I am an activist, and it's possible to do satire without it being that lazy, I guess. And I noticed that, like, most of the people that were making the think pieces about it being satire were dudes, like, explaining the dynamics of jokes, which kind of bothered me. And the other thing is, I keep hearing this term, the term third wave feminism, which the only time I've heard it is, like, kind of to demonize feminism in general. And I wanted to know if anyone had any thoughts on that.
Dr. Thorpe, you look like you're ready to jump there.
Yes, as someone who has would identify as a third-wave feminist, I would not say that I am demonizing the movement. Third-wave feminism is...
Oh, no, no, no. I didn't mean like you were demonizing it. The people who write about it are demonizing it.
Right, and I think when people try to demonize, it's interesting that people try to demonize third-wave feminism. I think that's just because it's the current iteration of feminism. But third-wave feminism is in many ways an attempt to try to address some of the problems, the white heteronormativity of second-wave feminism. But one of the issues with third-wave feminism is by making it a much more wide net, if you will, it has less of a political and legal focus and more of an identity focus. And in an age where identity politics is easy to lampoon, it becomes easy to demonize that way.
Chris, that address okay. It?
Yeah, that's all I wanted to know. I'm coming off of, I should say, I'm trying to be like a better person in general. Like I spent like my college years kind of in a hotep stage. And now I'm getting out of that and actually listening to people. So, you know, I'm just trying to figure out what to do to help.
Well, Chris, thank you. I appreciate that. Thanks for the phone call. I think a lot of people feel that way. And Sean in Rochester wants to know or wants to kind of weigh in with whether what happened in Boston is the right way to respond to this. Go ahead, Sean.
Thanks for this conversation. It's great. First of all, I think that Tina Fey's way going about this is totally wrong. I think that we need to come out in mass numbers as we did in Boston. I think it's also important to talk to people and understand and if anybody could comment a little more on intersectionality, which was developed by lesbian women in the Combahee River Collective, I think is really a great way to go. But one just other thing, I guess 40,000 people came out in Boston in mass mobilization. And what that does is that gets people to come out and actually confront the right. It actually gets us to build our side, build the left, get people to organize, show that we stand in solidarity. All those oppressed as white men, I need to stand in solidarity with people and I need to help in any way I can. And that also means understanding that people change through struggle and their consciousness changes through struggle. So if it's somebody's first rally, we want to welcome them and not blame them for not being at the last rally, but make them and motivate them to get to the next rally, because that's how we'll change the system. And the way to confront the right is what we did in Boston. And for anybody who wants to join that effort, we're having a rally in Fairport on Sunday against Nazi violence and in solidarity with Charlottesville, Boston, Berkeley, which has put a call out for this National Day of Solidarity. And we can all stand up together and show them that we will not live in fear and that united we are stronger and safer. Thank you very much.
Sean, thank you for the phone call. We're almost out of time. Amanda writes to the program and says, Evan, one of the best hours I've ever heard, and this panel is brilliant. Thanks to them for sharing and being present with us. With that, let me just ask Vanessa down to our last minute. Sean talked about what he'd like to see. We see stuff happening in our community. One of our callers that we can't get to, Zoe in Rochester, wanted to know, what's the advice for people who really do want to be allies? And we've heard a lot of talk about the definition of it and what it means. What do you say to that?
Honestly, I say whether you found Tina Fey's skit to be funny, whether you found it to be a satire or whatever, if you want to be an ally, the next step is to show up. If you think she was just joking about not going, then go. That's the next step. Come out, contact community leaders, find out what you can do. Take criticism and just all you have to say is, you know, okay, I'll try harder. And that's it. That, you know, nobody's asking you to kind of die on a hill. Unless it gets to that point, which I hope it doesn't. But but just in general, just the next step is to, you know, put your boots to the ground and come out. And like Sean said, you know, there is a rally coming up on Sunday and you should be there.
I want to thank all of our guests this hour. Vanessa Cheeks is a reporter for Open Mic Rochester, openmicrock.com. You can find her work there. Always good to have you. Thank you, Vanessa.
Thank you.
And Jackie McGriff, great to see you again. Feminist, photographer, former WXXI colleague here. Great to see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our thanks to Amber Tracy, a local artist and art educator. Thank you, Amber. And Dr. Elizabeth Thorpe, assistant professor of communications at the College of Brockport. You'll have a lot to talk about with your students who are coming back soon, I imagine.
It's going to be a great semester.
Short break. Much more Connections coming up next.